Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Ken Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my coverage from Venice Immersive 2025, today's episode is with a piece called The Time Before, which is a part of the competition at Venice Immersive, and it's a virtual reality piece that has kind of a mixed modes of both 360 video with animation, some CGI animation as well, or at least a, you know, computer-based hand-drawn animation within the context of more of a virtual space. And so it's kind of like blending together these different realms where the animation represents the dreamscape and the 360 video that is shot a lot of underwater represents kind of the dreams or the unconscious. And so there's this recalling of dreams, recalling of memories, and a bit of a confabulation between what is real and what's not, between what's real and what's dream and what's fantasy. And so the story is around like reckoning with the different traumas of the past. And so having different childhood memories and then seeing how that impacts this person in their daily life. And there's a sibling relationship as well. So the sister is like kind of helping this main character of this boy recount and deal with all these different modes of like active imagination and using the dreams and unconscious, and then dealing with, in the context of the story, is a very violent father. But as Leo, the director, told me, that's kind of like more of a narrative conceit to create some narrative tension to be able to further the story through aspects of drama. So the overall context of this piece is that it's a combination of these personal memories as well as fantastical dreamscapes created with the help of his sister in order to preserve his identity and his self in the context of dissolving and traumatic family home. So he's kind of exploring out this local neighborhood of nature and these implicit themes of death and the existential suffering from loss and grief. So this is very much center of gravity of the water element of the cinematic and storytelling, and very narrative driven and trying to evoke different emotions. And so it's looking at juxtaposing all these different modalities together, both the 360 video, but also the cinematic aspects of the CGI and animation, and also kind of a blending and blurring of those two together. And so seeing these underwater scenes that are 360 video and seeing the animations on top of that. And so there's a overall kind of theme around emotions in the struggle to kind of cathart and feel emotions, I think, is a main theme of this piece as well. The second center of gravity is the earth element that is this kind of mashup, all these different modalities of telling the story in the spatial way. It's kind of a unique blend of these different things together. And also Michael Golombowski is one of the main VR developers on this piece, and he was contributing to this conversation as well, and had a lot of very specific detailed things that he was doing in terms of laying out the spatial architecture of this piece. So pay attention particularly into some of those different ideas and thoughts, because there's a lot of deep thought in terms of how to juxtapose and compose these different modalities together, mashing up all these worlds together. And so Michael's someone who's a very deep thinker when it comes to like these theoretical aspects of immersive design, but it's also kind of on the front lines developing and designing, formerly with Anagram and now working on this project with Leo. And so the third center of gravity is the fire element. There are some light interactive components that you are embodying the boy and the character to kind of push forward the story. And so it's not just a completely passive story, but you're actually kind of engaging with your body at a certain point. And then the last and final fourth center of gravity is the air element. And that is just the fact that, you know, most of the different dialogues being coming through these different characters that are interacting with each other, but there's also this kind of blending and blurring between what's real, what's fantasy, what's kind of a memory of a dream, or what's a memory and within its own self. And so there's this kind of like speculative realm of the possibility spaces of these imagination, but also the core themes of memory and confabulation of that memory. And also when you're in this kind of more dreamlike space, then the rules are changing in terms of what's possible and what kind of things can happen within the context of the dreamscape versus the memoryscape. So overall, the themes around, like from their description, it says, quote, "This is a piece about escape, distortion, and the quiet cost of staying silent. Also about memory, imagination, and dreams." So dreams and fantasy. And so the main character, Ollie, quote, "delves into his childhood memories, navigating the fantastical dreamscapes his sister created to shield them from a fractured home." And then there's also ultimately trying to have a cathartic emotional expression, battling all the ways in which that we were shut down, locked up, or dealing with unexamined childhood traumas. He says, quote, "the difficulty many children, especially boys, carry into adulthood when taught to suppress emotion." So themes around, quote, "the emotional weight of a volatile father, a mother lost in the fog of memory, and a sister who offered escape through imagination and dreams." So there's a bit of a reckoning with the past and the memories, and being able to, quote, "consider the fragility of their own memory." So that's what we're covering on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Leo and Michael happened on Friday, August 29th, 2025, at Venice Immersive in Venice, Italy. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
Hello, my name is Leo Metcalf. I'm the director, producer, animator, editor, filmmaker, well, cameraman of The Time Before.
Hi, my name's Mike Olimbeski, and I was working with Leo on The Time Before. While Leo managed the more traditional filmy elements, what I did is work to bring the interactive design into that so that the interactive design is matching the narrative as well. I also handled the development of the project.
Great. Maybe you could each give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into working with VR.
Okay, how far back do we go? I spent 10 years doing radio production on health, education, environment in Madagascar and Afghanistan, and then I pivoted to documentary, did a master's in animation at the Royal College of Art, and did a 360 video, and that's when I pivoted to making things in interactive things in virtual reality with The Time Before.
What got you into VR? What was the catalyst?
I knew I wanted to make a piece about sort of consciousness and perception, and I was really fascinated by how consciousness bubbles up through the interplay of memory and perception. And so I thought the best way to approach that was to immerse people in the POV of someone. And I also knew I wanted to make something about memories and dreams, and again, for altered states of consciousness, it felt like putting people in virtual reality was the best way, including using mixed media to sort of show the different worlds. So there's live action and animation in the piece.
Yeah, just a bit more context as to your background and your journey into the space.
Perfect. If you take this background back to the start of it, basically, I started in the 90s working in a fine arts context. I'd worked with a lot of Fluxus artists and process artists, both as a practitioner. As that sort of evolved, mainly through the Fluxus side, it got into the integration of technology into the work, stuff like Nam June Paik, these sort of things. I was fascinated by it. I ended up studying interactive design at the Royal College of Art. And post finishing up at the Royal College of Art, I'd ended up working kind of in a more new media space with that. I did that professionally for a while, ended up working to look at the critical aspects of that when I did my doctorate, which was looking at the intersection of kind of material process and technological development. How do these two ways of making integrate when they have a lot of very different kind of concerns? So a bit with me that was fascinating from the VR side is VR comes into this because VR is in this position of kind of inventing its language of process. Fascinating. I'd ended up working as interactive design and development lead with a studio called Anagram. I worked on these projects, Make Noise. I was the lead developer, did a lot of design work with the Collider, and I was the design and development lead on Goliath. This was in the VR space. I also did a lot of installation-based work, working with VR that's a little bit funny, working on a project called Volo that was VR with swing sets, which was very nice. It's kind of very physically embodied, also very tricky to keep people from not getting sick when you're doing work like that, which is one of the more practical concerns. So I'd ended up working with Leo, and it was fantastic because his project had kind of come along, and I'd seen some of the preliminary versions of it. With his background at the RCA, I knew the sorts of work that he was doing animation style, the overall methods that he was using, and the kind of ethos he was taking into it. I found it wonderful. Like, it's design your own process, not cookie cutter. It's how do you work aesthetically in a way that really brings things together and merges both the technology and the conceptual aims. So Leo's project really jumped out at me as a potential project to work on. We put our heads together, and basically working with his film skills, his narrative abilities, I'd worked with the interactivity on that to figure out a way to make a fusion in the project that kind of worked in the medium and told his story well.
Yeah, so where did The Time Before begin? What was the spark or catalyst for this project?
So the catalyst was what I mentioned before, this desire to make something about consciousness and perception and do it in the world of VR. So I designed it as this sort of exploration that I wanted to do, and I wanted to look at childhood memory because I was interested also at the time about how we are who we are based on things from our childhood that we can't really remember, let alone understand, and trying to dig into that. So at the beginning, I actually made a 360 film called The Everything Move, which was at the RCA, which was a 4-minute piece, which was the same brother and sister. It's kind of a sequel. The Time Before is kind of a prequel to that piece. To be perfectly honest, and I hadn't thought I'd talk about this, but I wrote a huge piece called Notes on the Fifth Reflection that all these stories are coming out of. It's something I've been working on for sort of 15 years, which was, again, consciousness, perception, and also like what it is to be conscious. Is it something, do you have to receive stimulus? Do you have to have agency? Do you have to have another being there for communication? So this was all the stuff that I was very excited about. So I started like that, and I designed it with an older sister. I do have an older sister. Very early on in the project, I decided to make the father this angry figure, which my father is not an angry figure. My father is a very kind and gentle man. but I needed narrative conflict to try and get things moving. So at the beginning, I didn't think it was that much of a personal tale. I thought it was an exploration of childhood. But then progressively, as production went through and I went to therapy and I was working through things, I realized that the piece was actually a very personal piece, and it was about my emotional stuntedness. So it was almost like an organic process where my conscious mind was working on sort of the form and the aesthetic and the general area and theme, whereas my subconscious mind was actually working on the deep underlying things that were going on. And I came to realize that sort of 2-3 years into production, that it was a film about me.
And do you have a pretty vivid dream life?
I do. I find it quite... my girlfriend might not love this, but it's frustrating being in a couple because you can't keep dreams. I used to record my dreams in the morning, but you're going to wake someone up and say very strange things when they're just waking up. So I had a period of time when I was doing a lot of lucid dreaming to explore stuff, which... I mean, it was kind of like, rather than exploring my subconscious, though, I would just fly. A lot of times I would just kind of flap my arms and try and give like texture to the air to be able to push off. And then I would just go flying. But recently, as I said, like I haven't been able to do as much lucid dreaming as I'd want to. I've actually been doing some therapy, EMDR therapy, which has really been doing strange things. So recently I've been having very personal dreams, actually. And trying to remember them without recording them on my phone in the morning.
Yes, that's a big theme within the context of this piece, is the dreams and the role of dreams, and also memory and the ways that we're working through things both on a conscious and unconscious level. And so maybe as we start to explore this piece, there's a distinct fusion of different styles, from like 360 video to animation to some interactive bits. And so just curious, like, how you started to design the narrative structure of this piece and to tell the story. And it sounds like, you know, with this animation, you're able to do these kind of hand-drawn animations and put them in and create this whole fusion between mixed reality, in the sense that you're mixing the animation with the VR, but still also with interactive parts. So yeah, just curious to hear like your process to create the narrative structure and how you start to describe what the structure is.
So in terms of like, well, for the form, like the drawing and the animation was, I used to doodle in class when I was quite young, but then I stopped drawing for years, never keeping it up as a hobby, which is sad, but also never thinking, at the time I didn't think I was going to have a creative career. I wasn't brave enough basically to think I could have a creative career. So I ended up working for NGOs for years. So my drawing is quite simple, this kind of childlike drawings, but I think they fit that world of childhood really well, because it looks like drawings that a child might make. So representing the memories of a child seems to work with the structure. That's an interesting question, because I haven't really thought about that recently. Part of it was in terms of, again, coming back to the form, like I'd been filming underwater for about 15-20 years, so I had all this footage that I loved, and I'd made these sort of short meditative videos which are on my website called Flexions, with just sort of sound and an image. But I hadn't actually made something more with these underwater pieces. But I loved them. I made a documentary, and I had a Canon 5D, which was one of the first digital SLRs that you could use to shoot in. And I had like a glorified plastic bag that I bought on the internet, and I would take it underwater and hope that it didn't leak. And I would shoot in rivers, in streams, you know, in the sea, in caves, wherever I could. So I knew I wanted to use that, and I knew that it had this dreamy underwater sort of feeling. So I got a 360 camera at the beginning of production of the time before to be able to shoot in 360 to add to this stuff. So that was that for the form. When it came to the structure, can I say anything about the way the structure? I'm trying to think back, because it feels like it was about 3 years ago the last time I actually worked on the structure. I don't know. Let me think about that one.
Yeah, well, let's stick with the form, and then we'll maybe come back to that. So a lot of this piece is the compositing of these different layers, and it sounds like a lot of that was facilitated by a lot of the work that you were doing in terms of blending all these different things together. So just curious to hear a little bit more around the collaborative process and trying to show Leo what was possible, but also work with him and trying to understand how you wanted to kind of blend all this stuff together.
I mean, there's a stuff that's a little bit of the glue to it, that's the technical glue, which is conceptually maybe the less interesting side, but it's nonetheless a very important factor. couple of things on it are we're working on mobile hardware. We'd had our original kind of like launch target being the Quest 2. We want not just the people who can afford the latest and greatest to be able to use it, but also people who are working a generation back. So because of that, there was a distinct challenge with both the size and resolution and number of sprites we had was actually pretty big. Hand-drawn animations aren't compressed in the same way as a lot of media. So that introduces a little bit of a challenge. Also, we had a lot of 360 video and we needed to have these seamlessly integrated. So it actually does hit a little bit of a hardware threshold. So there was a layer of work under the hood, basically rewriting video shaders, writing bespoke video shaders that could support some interaction, getting the sprites to play with some custom compression. But that's kind of boring stuff. Necessary, but boring. But where, to me, it really came home with the narrative side was how do we start merging this compositing technique in a way that plays with it? Because we're working in a 3D space. I mean, VR is inherently a three-dimensional medium, and it's at its best when it does it. So we've got a monoscopic 360 video setup. We weren't shooting stereo because we wanted the resolution. So it's monoscopic to the higher resolution. But what that does is that puts all of your content on the horizon. Effectively. It's the way your eyes work. If something's monoscopic, your brain interprets that as it's very far away. Now, it does that physiologically. Compositionally, we still read all the rules that we're trained as. We see thousands of photographs a day. All the visual cues of composition, this sits next to that, this is bigger than that, this gives us one sense of scale. But it's kind of a learned sense. It's something we learn from reading a photograph as an image. But under the hood, our body's telling us something completely different. Our body's using the left eye, right eye. To determine scale in a less kind of literate sense. We're all very literate in photography and reading scale on that. Because we see so many, depth is a little bit more instinctive. And one, to me, the real telling thing with Leo's project is we're in the situation where we're combining both this compositional view and also the physiological, and the fact that we're using the three-dimensional sprites, because the sprites are 2D drawings, but they're placed in a 3D space. Over this horizon image, let us play a lot of games. And I can give an example of some of those. The father figure, you know, the under the table scene. The father figure, I wanted him, based on the narrative, the role of this character is he's massive, distant, and imposing. So all the sprites of the father are actually 10 meters tall, 40 meters away, which put him in the same compositional size as the other figures, but your brain under the hood, there's a layer of your brain that's reading the composition, that's saying the father's where he should be. There's a layer of your brain that's reading the depth, and that says this is a massive distant thing. So I wanted to try to start to integrate these little bits of incongruity in terms of scale and depth to play with the fact that we've got this combination of compositional depth and physiological depth. And it's a thing that's not really a noticeable consciously, but it puts the mood that this is big and distant, this is small and close. How do you play off of these with the narrative? It seemed very much like a theme. Like another way that we played with this is as the scene goes across, physiologically the world is shrinking. The first scenes, everything's massive, both compositionally and distance-wise of scale. You have the scene in the crib with the baby. You see the sister massive and blurry. Under the table, the sister's 2 meters tall, even compositionally. The world shrinks as your options compress. As the world becomes a bit darker, it becomes smaller, less open. These are the sorts of things that we could play with on the composition that were great. So it's a way of kind of subtly, through engaging with the technology as a media, we can use it to support in kind of our own way the narratives. Like, because Leo's story is amazing, and it needs some experimentation on the media side to make the depth of the story match the capabilities of the technology. And like, to me, it's an exciting project because it's not use a game engine and a rigged character and make it work normal. It's figure out your own grammar for this piece. And there's not a lot of grammar for this sort of work, so it's exciting.
If I could just say a little bit more about marrying especially the live action and the 2D stuff. I think a thing that when you're trying to marry animation, 2D animation with live action video, I think it's quite hard to do, but I think the magic sauce here was the underwater element. The fact that everything is submerged underwater and in water meant that having the 2D sprites as sort of these floating figures and then just adding a little tint to make them underwater was something that helped with that. One last thing I did want to say about the... All of the underwater shots have this dreamy aspect also because they're compositions of many, many different shots. So with the digital SLR, I would shoot reflections above the water and reflections under the water and underwater shots. And then I got the 360 camera and did underwater shots. But then every shot has 5, 6, 7 different things going on. So it might be the algae will be from somewhere, the layer you're seeing up top will be from somewhere, but in the middle there'll be like a window onto somewhere else, so which gives it that sort of dreamy aspect. And that took a long time. There was a lot of time sort of feathering and blurring and making it all seem as if it was the same underwater scene. And I don't know what took the longest in that project, but that was one of the things that took me a long time in After Effects.
And another thing with the underwater scenes that was really fun, it was one of my favorite parts, kind of studio experimentation wise. After it was done, it turned into my favorite while it was going on, like always, where solving problems and kind of having the debate. But one of the things that worked very nicely in it was the underwater scenes, in order to keep them from feeling a bit flat, we worked with minuscule particle systems just at the edge of perception inside of that. We pulled them out kind of heavily every now and then to get an effect at the end of the camera dropping scene, at the end of scene 6. The particle systems hang for just a minute longer and kind of hover. But basically, these particle systems mirrored the visual aesthetic of the underwater scenes just enough to keep your eye moving through the depth. Because your eye's not just moving left and right, it's also kind of moving forward and back as you focus forward and back. These particle systems gave it something to hang onto that wasn't just a binary. It wasn't just sprites background. It gave your eye a little bit of room to breathe as it's moving forward and back.
Yeah, and as I think about this project, there's so much around the unique grammar that is formed by this composition and collaging of all these different images. And so I guess to revisit the narrative structure, because when I think around like the difference between game design versus filmmaking, a lot of times in filmmaking, you'll write a script and then you'll produce it because you kind of know what to expect. But in game design, it's more iterative in the sense that you have to kind of see what it feels like and then you are kind of building it out from there. And so I'm imagining that there's a little bit of both of like, you maybe have a sense of what the story you want to tell, but the mechanics of how that happens is going back and forth between these shots that you're kind of organically building out and seeing what's even possible with this compositional style. So just curious to hear a little bit more elaboration on that narrative design process, because, you know, so much of this piece is dictated by this kind of unique grammar that you're developing.
I do want to say that like the bare bones of the structure of the story were written from very early on, and like, you know, I had a script and I knew where I was going. There are elements, so for example, interestingly, at the beginning I wanted both parents to be sort of these nasty, distant, emotionally abusive people. But then afterwards I realized maybe the mum shouldn't be, and then my mum was very ill at the time with cancer. So I ended up, she ended up passing away during production. But even before she passed away, I ended up thinking a lot more about memory and thinking about how, what memory is. Is memory visuals? Is memory words? Is memory sounds? Is memory smells? And how does memory work for us? So I became very interested in like trying to think through that, and that's why there's a whole section in the piece where I take advantage of the fact that people are in the dark VR headset and you can tell them to close their eyes, and whether they do or not, they're in the dark, and you can get them to try and reflect on their memory and how their memory works. So that was part of it. When it came to the interactions and the way working through the interactions, I very early on had this sense that I have this sort of strong sense that interactions should be there to keep you immersed in the world and keep you engaging with the world. I had no desire to make anything gamified. I really didn't want the parts of the audience's brain, participants' brain, to be sort of, how can I do this better? How can I do this faster? To light up, because I felt like in a short, dreamy piece like this, the important thing was for them to be in a state where the part of the brain that lets narrative wash over you and engage emotionally with the story is by far the most important bit. So it was very early on trying to decide how that would work. So there are scenes which perhaps Mike can talk a bit more about, but the throwing pebble scenes and stuff where, for example, the throwing pebbles with the sister, what I really want to get the sense is that you're there, you're in the world, and you're playing with her. And you're not playing to win or doing some kind of game, you're just having this sort of playful interaction. But maybe Mike has some...
Yeah, like that's an interesting scene, both technically and interactionally, the pebble throwing scene, and narratively as well. Because it's really the first time in the experience that narratively that you gain full agency. You're inhabited, you're situated in the body of Ollie through the experience, but the first time you have any real agency in the experience is when you're able to throw that pebble. It's the first time that you're acting instead of being acted at, in a way. So it's a powerful moment, and one of the things on that, in particular because we wanted this to be running on mobile hardware, I was pretty against the idea of any kind of VR water. It's difficult to do right even on a high-end system on the Quest 2. It's just not going to be plausible in a way. So it set up a nice kind of technical challenge there, was figuring out how do you make the video itself interactive, where we've got the video of the water. A lot of, basically, a lot of math goes into figuring out how to composite kind of a ripple effect into a video that's playing live, based on where your head is, where your hand is, where the rock is. Getting that to hold together was a little bit of a challenge. But what that scene really needed to make that work was a visual contrast, a foreground element that made the background feel like the pebble was going in the water. That's why we have the stump scene. That's why we have the little forest clearing in the billow. That was added as an interactional necessity to the set, because what you needed is a foreground-background distinction in order for that sort of interaction, the composited video, to hold together. So when we have those stumps, when we've got that little clearing area, that's actually the glue that makes that stone-throwing interaction possible. That's one of the few spots where, to get the interactive technique to work, where we had to modify the original content structure to put in new elements to make these work. So this was interesting in that. But one of the other things with this that was interesting is we had to work very tightly with the narrative, because especially in festival contexts, people might not do the interaction. And you can't have a festival work pausing and having an indeterminate timeline. It doesn't work logistically, doesn't work experientially. So what we also had built into the piece was a lot of fallback material, where if you don't do the interaction, there's a minuscule path deviation that still makes it hold together. The animations that the sister's doing work whether you throw the pebbles or not. It picks up in a way that makes sense based on your action. So we actually had to massage that a little bit to make the interactions carry across the theme, regardless as to whether you did them or not. You still did them, but it couldn't kill the piece if you didn't, but because of the context we're showing it in. So this was a challenge, whereas if it was a more gamified environment, you'd hold on that. You'd keep repeating until they do the game action. But we're not working in that space. These are one-shots. So you have to have, if everything goes wrong, the show still goes on.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think when I did it, I had trouble on one of the actions where I wasn't able to throw the stone right. And it did feel like I was blocked for a bit, but I was able to eventually get it. But yeah, I guess that's a dilemma within making these type of interaction projects, because you don't want to like create a gap so that people have to do the action in order to proceed, because, you know, I'm mostly interested in the narrative anyway. And so when I run into that friction, it can be frustrating in a way that feels like either I'm not doing it right, or if the technology wasn't sort of like, I don't know if I saw an earlier build or if that was the same build or.
It's possible, I'm not sure.
The latest build, I mean, one of the fun things and also terrifying things about these sorts of things on the, this is going vaguely into the development side. One of the things that's simultaneously very useful and very challenging or terrifying is we decided very early on when we started getting this version going that we're going to use the meta distribution model from the development side. So full release channel package, great for getting things between the two of us. We basically had a working build running pretty early on in the project. So we had a shipped copy. Things that are nice about that is you're able to share it with collaborators. You can put somebody on the headset to give you a little bit of feedback, to give proof of concepts. It massively de-technologized our collaboration process, because all of a sudden, instead of, oh yeah, sync your GitHub, do a build, blah, 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 these are irrelevant things from an animation and filmmaking perspective. Animators and filmmakers don't need to be doing that as part of their process. The advantage of the release channel process is that the build things, all the and everything that might go wrong with that can be handled with a dev hat on. Then we're able to share just the interactivity, just the content across the release channel model. So this is great from a workflow standpoint. It's also fantastic when you get to the end game, when you're doing the distribution side, because all of a sudden when we're dealing with press, when we're dealing with festivals, it's, yeah, send me your email address. You'll get an email back, click the link, and then you can put on your headset and watch it. Now, okay, start up side quest, and you're going to sideload the OBB, but you got to rename the file to this and change the paper, blah, 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 and it turns into nonsense in about 5 minutes. So we did a bit of extra technical work at the side to set us up a workflow that stripped the technology out and let us focus on the real meat of the story, which is not the technology. It's the interactivity combining with the narrative.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to the narrative because, you know, as I watched this piece and, you know, the thing that's really sitting with me is this, what feels like a real exploration of these core memories, and maybe if they're dramatized in a way that's serving the narrative, but still at the same time, the ways that we exist as humans, but yet there are these things that happen to us in childhood that stick with us, that become a part of our core character. And so it seems like this piece is like a meditation on some of those core memories. And just curious to hear around your own process of like making this piece. And, you know, it sounds like there's a bit of a transformative process that you went through from the beginning and to the end, and kind of a path of unraveling, self-discovery, transformation. So yeah, just love to hear a little bit more around the original intent of what you were trying to do, and then a little bit more around your journey of what unfolded after the process of working on this over a number of years.
Yeah, so I mean, my discovery was that the piece was, I mean, it's extraordinary in a way when you think about it. I have this last mirror scene, which clearly depicts, and I don't think it's a spoiler for people to know this, but it depicts the fact that Ollie, the boy, becomes sort of emotionally stunted and unable to express strong emotions. And that's something that I came to understand was representative of me. And I think I could cry once in a while on airplanes at cheesy movies or whatever, but I had not cried about anything important or anything of depth for many, many years. And it was through therapy, and it was through my mum passing away and things like this that I realized that this was a thing that was happening. And that, and since, I've had some friends who've, you know, one friend who passed away and another friend who went through some serious mental health issues, and I have cried. So like, there has, through the film and through therapy, I've also feel like I've changed. Like, making the film was in a way therapeutic for me, getting me to the state where now I was very good at being compassionate, empathetic, and feeling raw emotions for other people who are having problems, but I could never do it for myself, and I could never do it for myself relative to those people anyway. But now that's something that has changed. Yeah, I think that's
Well, you said that you had created some pieces that were dramatized around your father. I'm just curious if your father has seen this piece and what his thoughts or reactions to it are.
So I showed it to my father. This is why in any kind of interview or online thing, I always want to say my father is a kind and gentle man, and this is not my father from the piece. My emotional stuntedness comes from various things, including we moved a lot when I was young, every few years, and I had quite a few nannies that kept changing, so these maternal figures would disappear, and there's other aspects of how I grew up. But it wasn't that there was this sort of evil fatherly presence at all, which is where it is interesting, because I think in terms of the landscape of things that are going on in the world today, I think there is quite a bit of on the manosphere and things where we're returning to these ideas of men have to be men and not show emotions and be strong, and which I completely disagree with. And in some way, that wasn't my personal experience. That's not why I ended up not being able to engage with my emotions. But I think that that's very important. And I think that it's incredibly important in this world to think about the fact that men and women, not only men, should be able to engage with their feelings early on and talk to other people about their feelings, because otherwise you end up stuck in a box, and if you're sort of emotionally isolating yourself from your own emotions and from being able to talk to them with others, that's not going to be helpful for your happiness in this world, I don't think.
Yeah, and just to unpack a little bit more on this therapeutic aspect of creating the piece, and just curious if there were things that you had unconsciously put into the piece that you discovered later, or you know, how was it therapeutic? Specifically, what were the types of things that you were discovering?
Oof, okay. Let me think about that. I think the two big things was this emotional stuntedness, which I think my subconscious slot that in there very early on. Like I said, the mirror scene, that was all written before I even started much production. I'd just done a few tests, but I somehow wasn't conscious of it. And even if I was a little bit, I did not apply it to myself. I did not think that this is something that had to do with me. So there was that, and especially this thing around memory and loss, which was around my mum passing away and pre my mum passing away. And, you know, thinking about like, one interesting thing about that is, I guess it's changing now because people have a lot more videos of people. We didn't tend to film much in my family. So one thing that I did do before my mum passed is made sure I recorded her voice, because everyone ends up with lots of photos. But at least in the past, and I think this is probably changing now, but you often don't have much recordings of what they sounded like, which is so much of how what they are and who they meant, what they meant to you, can be brought back so much by hearing a voice than from looking at photos that often, again, replace the memories in a way, because you see the photo again and again. Whereas I think like even like not that long a stretch of audio, if you have that, it just has this richness to it.
Yeah, and Mike, I'd love to hear any reflections on the narrative and story as you're working on it, and these reflections of memories and early childhood. I'm just curious to hear some of your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. Well, narrative-wise, it's very nice. Like, one of the big things that I love in the piece is it maintains across a lot of the scenes a certain layer of ambiguity. Are you dealing with a memory? Are you dealing with a dream? Are you dealing with the memory of a dream? There's a little bit of a liminal space where each scene can kind of be read through any of those lenses, and it holds together as a story, which is fantastic. You can read the story with the scenes being dreams, memories, or recollections of dreams, and it still works. It maintains that ambiguity, which is very nice. Now, a thing that's interesting with that from the interactional standpoint is that it becomes all about the transitions. And transitions in the VR sense are complicated sometimes. You have technical complications on it. I mean, at the end of the day, we're pushing a lot of bytes around to get that video and those sprites loaded in time. A lot of work under the hood to make it so that we can seamlessly transition from scene to scene. Things to make it so that we have a consistent audio layer that plays across, and being able to compress the transitions when it's unloading and loading a lot of assets in between an eye blink. The eye blink was a motif that both served a narrative purpose across the piece, also served a very important technological purpose. The eye blinks were our segue buffers. All of the stage set scenography, effectively the virtual scenography, was shifting in between an eye blink, hidden from the user, but they also served a narrative role, so it didn't feel immediately like, oh, the eyes blinked and now it's loading stuff, now they opened up again. They're serving this dual role of a technical purpose, also an interactional and narrative purpose. So it's like things like that worked really nicely. And I think that this helped to maintain that ambiguity around the dream states because it made the experience feel like a seamless flow. We didn't have hard gaps between scenes, hard cuts that kind of differentiated it. Even though there were thematic cuts, it was a smoothly flowing experience from start to finish, even extending to the end credit scene, also serving narrative roles. It was a bit that I was really impressed with in Leo's script. Usually it's cut, fade to black, and the credits are going in, but his credit scene actually ties in with the narrative just as much as the rest of the work, which is cool and rare to see.
Yeah, remind me again what happens during the credits?
He has the inside of the credits, as the credits are kind of rolling, you've got this reflective monologue. That's the introduction to the credits. It's really the piece that kind of frames, it's the end frame of the story, that this is a recollection, this is an adult reflecting. Doesn't really come out in the piece until that one line in the credits comes in, wraps the whole story up. And then in your head, as the credits are going, your brain is going back through that whole experience as you're reading the credits and saying, ah, this is somebody remembering this, this is somebody remembering this. It's not instant in the moment. It's a bit that you kind of reflect back on with this new point of view. And using the credits as the buffer area for you to do that reflection, rather than take the headset off and do it, especially in a festival, then you're in the middle of a zoo again. Being able to do that inside the credit scene, I found that to be, on Leo's kind of scripting side, I found that to be kind of a stroke of genius.
Yeah, I think one of the things that was really striking to me was just the water as a metaphor for, you know, diving down into the unconscious or going into the dreams or into your memories. And so you have a lot of these scenes of the childhood versions of yourself and your sister swimming in the pond, but also talking about dreams and the nature of dreams, the importance of dreams and writing down the dreams, but also like the symbol of the water as the unconscious and so diving into the unconscious. And so, yeah, just curious to hear any reflections on water, the use of water as this metaphor across these many different spectrum from memories, the unconscious, and dreams.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty much it, is that the water does represent sort of the subconscious and the unavailability and like almost the muffledness also of, for me, of engaging with these memories, because, you know, they feel like they're deep and almost unavailable and you can't actually access them. I had a quick thought of something I wanted to say, but I've forgotten it. Sorry.
Memory.
Exactly. Lack of.
I can talk a little bit about the audio side, because there's a nice kind of technical and material kind of resonance from how we manage the audio in the experience that mirrors what's going on in the video. In the same way that we were working with the composite of the 2D and 3D, where paradoxically the 2D elements were in 3D. The drawings were actually positioned in 3D space. The 3D elements, the video, was positioned as a monoscopic sphere. You have this nice reversal of this is actually flat, this is surface. Going on, we had the same thing happening with the audio, where we worked with a combination of headlock stereo for some elements and ambisonic for other, to play off of this kind of like the headlocked audio, kind of like bringing in this as a static memory. You have the ambisonics giving you that sense of depth. And the thing that was really nice in that is that there's a similar kind of reflective process where you have two versions of the same sort of media, one spatialized, one less spatialized. It's not just visual, it's also happening in the audio, and it's a very nice way to make those two gel together.
Yeah, I just wanted to, well, send a shout out to the person, Harry Parsons, who did the audio, the design. I gave him some elements, but he really made this beautiful, rich, ambisonic audio design from the very... He was on board from the project from the very beginning, which really adds that feeling of being underwater, especially in a lot of those scenes. And I wanted to say Vasilis Alevizos, who's the composer, also made very early on these pieces of music, which again are there quite subtly, but give you this submerged, underwater, quite trippy and eerie thing. And I wanted to come back to, I've remembered what I wanted to say earlier, which is just about the dreaming and the lucid dreaming. Like I said, I spent quite a lot of time engaging with lucid dreaming and thinking about lucid dreaming. And it was in the context of this wider piece, the Notes on the Fifth Reflection, from which, if I make a sequel of this, that's where I'm going to pull it, because I know what happens. I just don't know exactly how. But in that case, you have lucid dreaming, which allows you, very simply, allows you to remember your dreams a lot better and have more of an idea of what your dream were, because the more you practice remembering your dreams, the more you actually end up remembering your dreams. And I found that very fascinating in this case, where you could imagine having a sister teaching her younger brother, who's only just discovering reality, you know, our material reality, our waking world reality, but has also given access to his dreams and access to this other dimension of reality. And I found that sort of fascinating, how that would sort of bend and twist your perspective, which also plays into the piece, because it's obviously, as Mike was saying, is it a dream? Is it a memory of a dream? What are we looking at? What are we thinking about here?
Yeah, there was a conversation I had with Elizabeth Honer, who has been working with someone who was doing Jungian dream work, and she was having a dream and then going into tilt brush, open brush, and painting out the dream. And she described it as a sort of act of imagination of re-entering into the dream in a way that was helping to kind of unlock other aspects of really being present within that dream above and beyond lucid dreaming. And so, yeah, it seems like that there's a way in which that the language and grammar of VR within itself is kind of mirroring the types of grammar that we see within our dreams. And so there's a sort of symbolic logic or dream logic that we have in even the grammar of these pieces, where you have both the individual personal symbols, collective symbols, but also universal symbols that span the full spectrum of, as we look at our dreams, trying to decode them and understand them. But even as we're having a number of different projects here at Venice Immersive 2025, there's a number of pieces that I think some of the stronger ones end up really heavily leaning into that dream logic in a way that allows the emotion to come up without having a lot of the explicit narrative of that. I think in your piece, you have a very clear narrative that's, narrated, but I feel like there's a way in which that the VR medium within itself is drawing upon the language and grammar of dreams. And I'm sure that that'll also, the more the medium develops, will also be feeding back into our dreams. So I don't know if making this piece has also changed your dreams, or what kind of feedback loop cycle, or if you have any other comments on this kind of dream logic that we see as a part of the grammar and language of VR.
I think just in terms of my own approach to dreams, I used to lucid dream mainly to be able to fly, because who doesn't want to fly? That sounds like the most amazing thing. But I think personally, I had a very strong belief that, Freud was all about, dreams and sex and dreams. But that was all, I don't know, for some reason in my mind, it was that's been discounted and that's, it's not that relevant. Whereas recently I've been, the things we dream about, it is a way of the subconscious coming to the surface, which is something I think I discounted for years, whereas now I'm more engaged with thoughts about that. Which is, again, this dream logic and having the piece using these dreams as access to another world, but also the world inside ourselves, which, as you say, VR is a very good way of plunging people into them.
Any reflections on the relationship between dreams and the grammar of VR?
It's a good question, that one. So with dreams and the grammar of VR, one of the things that VR does afford grammatically, and I think that it's partially due to where it is as a medium right now, where there's some conventions that have started to develop interactionally, but there's a lot of flexibility for rules changing over time in the way where more codified sorts of design, you say 3D gaming, control systems are heavily codified. or like third-person gaming, first-person gaming, your control systems, how you interact with the system, they're codified. The moment you start breaking or bending those rules, it's immediately obvious. When we're working in VR, those rules are starting to exist, but they haven't coagulated. They're kind of half-cooked. There's basic control systems, there's basic conventions, but they're also pretty loose. One of the advantages that gives you narratively is it lets you very comfortably start to change the rules mid-system, and it does it in a way that's less confrontational, and that's exactly how a dream changes. Dream doesn't change all at once. You realize in the middle of the dream that all the rules have changed. You realize that your legs are moving, but you're no longer walking. You know, it kind of, you notice it, it doesn't immediately pop out at you. And VR is just at the sweet spot where, as a medium, you can shift those rules and weave it into the narrative without a lot of mental workload on the part of the user. You don't have to do as many tricks as you'd have to do if you did that in a traditional game, or if you did that in a traditional film, which has another 100 years of codification on top of it, you know? To break those rules, you've got to be really good at breaking the rules and changing the rules to the point where that becomes the entire piece. In VR, those rules are still loose enough that you can change them and still have the piece be about something other than changing the rules.
Yeah, that's real insightful there, and I agree with that. Yeah, I'm just curious how the screenings have been going so far here at Venice for the time before.
It's been going well. We've been getting very positive feedback from people. I haven't been hanging around the booth enough to be grabbing people as they get off, but I've met people who have seen it who are all very moved, and it's very strange because some people, you know, get very moved by the story and they tell me it made them think about memory, and then there's some people who are very focused on the grammar of the piece, the way it's made with 2D and 3D and underwater, and how they'd not seen that particular kind of aesthetic. So it's been the response of both in terms of, I mean, I do just a quick thing on the aesthetic as there was a lot of hand-done elements in the piece, which I think is visible in the aesthetic, and that's something that we're moving forwards to make another piece now in science fiction, which I hope we're going to, I mean, I know we're going to take forwards because we love that texture that it gives.
Yeah, for sure.
I've got to give one thing on the festival setup, and I've got the thing where one of the things that ends up happening when you do have a hand in the development side of it, as well as in the technical, as well as conceptual development side of things, you get the little bit of the mother hen instinct, like, oh my God, this is a, is it okay? Is it all working? Did it all crash? One of the things that's always amazing with the Venice team that every year that I've been here, the back of house technical team and the front of house invigilation team are both stellar at their jobs. I mean, it is, in terms of an installation venue that's doing this many pieces in a technical sense, every piece feels like it's the complete occupation of the whole staff. That's not by accident. The people at Venice Immersive that do the back of house and the front of house dealing with the guests are, I'd say, the best in the world. And it's a real privilege as somebody who makes things to be able to have that level of care taken with your work once you get into the festival. So you've got to give a shout out to the entire team here just as doing amazing work.
Yeah, I'd just love to say, yeah, exactly the same sentiment. I think Michelle and Liz and Chiara, who is someone I was emailing with to get a lot of the material, have been fantastic. And also the docents who are taking care of the pieces are just very friendly and very helpful. So yeah, it's been amazing. It's such a incredible place to show your piece, and a place where, you know, VR is given a place of importance rather than being tagged on, which can be the case.
Yeah, it's certainly one of the most robust selections, and yeah, all the technical glitches that have to be worked out. Every year I run into some things where there's some sort of technical glitch, but eventually gets solved. So yeah, there's an excellent team that's putting this all together. And it's my favorite place to come and see work as well. So as a fan of the space.
I mean, it becomes even more impressive because it's a historic site that has zero modern infrastructure. The power, the telecommunications, the water, all of that is brought in on site. A couple of weeks before the show, it's basically like doing an exhibition in the wilderness in terms of infrastructure. And they make it happen like it feels like you're in a museum.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. And finally, what do you each think is the ultimate potential of virtual reality and immersive storytelling, and what it might be able to enable?
Well, so I think I think virtual reality, I've listened to a lot of your podcasts. I should have seen this question coming. I should have thought about it before. But I think that virtual reality, I think the strength in being able to tell narrative stories in a completely different medium is the thing that I'm most excited about, and the thing that I think there are increasing pieces, but there has been a poverty of such pieces in the past where you're taken on an incredible narrative journey that makes you engage both physically and emotionally and with a story and takes you and puts you in these worlds and these perspectives. I mean, this is why, like, just in terms of the time before, like, you know, putting people in, you know, a four-year-old, so putting them under the table and making them the size of what a four-year-old would be, and like doing all these aspects and having them turn because they hear shouting to their left or to their right. And like, I guess personally, because I haven't thought about a clever one, I would just say the narrative. That's what I'm most excited about, is pushing this forwards and seeing how you can use the new medium and engage with what makes it different to tell different stories in different ways.
I mean, for me, I just find it endlessly fascinating with VR, in that what we're in this position to be seeing and to be working with as practitioners is the concurrent evolution of the medium and the tools of the medium. So you've got how you develop and make a story in VR, how you work in mixed reality as a way to express emotion, to express lived experience, human complexity. That's growing and evolving. And right alongside that, the tools and technologies that we're using are looking at how people are telling stories, and those are starting to shift how the tools evolve. And the idea that you have this kind of concurrent kind of narrative development dovetailing with the technological development is a very interesting place to be a fly on the wall, and even better, it's a place to be somebody working, because you get to see this interplay between the technological development and the narrative aesthetic development and how they feed off of each other. Each one informs the other one, and the direction that's going in, I don't know what it's going to be, but I'm very much looking forward to seeing what it turns into.
Great. Is there anything else that's left unsaid that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
Not much, just thanks, Kent, for this podcast you provide. It's been something, I've done some teaching and I've given it to lots of students, because in terms of trying to get people to get an overview of what's happening in the world of VR and doing some deep thinking about it, I think you provide them invaluable resource. So thanks. Thanks, Kent.
Quite welcome. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I'd say just from the VR community side, the thank you is the biggest thing to do for it. And it's also tremendously exciting to see people coming from so many different threads of VR, commercial, industrial, art house narrative, Hollywood. The VR flavors of all of these come together into one place, and having conversations about the direction the media is going into is absolutely amazing to see.
Awesome. Well, Leo and Mike, thanks again for joining me here on the podcast today. And yeah, I feel like your piece is exploring a lot of interesting thematic things around dreams and memories and identity and how it's tied into all that. And also just the mixed media format of, it's not, you know, I guess it is a form of mixed reality of having like the 360 video with animation. It's like a little bit more symbolic and crafted with your hands through the animation style, but still kind of an interesting blending and blurring of these different formats in a way that creates something new that allows us to explore the kind of intersection of our dreams, our memories, and our traumas and stories that we have. And yeah, so it's just a really great to see how all those things are coming together with the sound design and interaction in there as well to create something that is unique and novel. Yeah.
Sorry, can I add a last?
Yeah, sure.
Last little thing about that. The way I meant to say this earlier, but I did have this sort of rule at the beginning that all the memories of Ollie that were true memories would be animated, and then all the dreams would be these underwater dreams that he would be lucid dreaming, because his sister and him played by the forest and by the water and stuff. And that's what, using the mixed media in that way, and then when you start seeing the merges collide and combine, is which adds to even more of the mess of what you're looking at.
Yeah, another level of that mixed reality. So yeah, awesome. Well, thanks again for joining me here on the podcast to help break it all down.
Thank you so much, Kent.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for tuning into this Venice Immersive 2025 coverage, and hopefully you found some use in some of this documentation of these experiences that are very ephemeral. And some of these show at these festivals, and they don't really go out widely beyond this a lot of times. I mean, maybe they are, but you may not be in a place that it's easy for you to see them. And so it's a real privilege to be able to see all these experiences, but also to be able to sit down with these creators and have a really deep, in-depth conversation in a way that there are not a lot of other opportunities to really dig into at this level. And so really appreciate all the time from all the creators to be able to have these conversations, but also for you to take the time to listen to them. And also it's been a challenge of trying to find a way of speaking about these experiences in an abstract, theoretical way, or at least in a way that I can ground it and allow you to put yourself into the experiences to kind of imagine some of these different things that they're doing, how I'm experiencing it, but also the different types of design decisions that the creator is making. So if you find this useful and want to support this type of effort of both documenting the history of immersive storytelling, but also to support this kind of wildly ambitious independent journalism project that is very much driven by support by listeners like yourself. So please do consider becoming a member of the Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.